Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Dublin Unitarian Church, whether you are here in person or joining us on the web or listening back afterwards. If this is your first time here with us, you are particularly welcome. My name is Elaine Sisson. I'm a member of the congregation here. Dublin Unitarian Church has a tradition of an open pulpit, which means that members of the congregation are invited and encouraged to lead the service. So today is my turn. Today we also mark Remembrance Sunday to remember members of the congregation who died in wars and also the opportunity to remember people close to us who we have lost. Our opening words. We bid you welcome. We bid you welcome who come with weary spirit seeking rest, who come with troubles that are too much with you, who come hurt and afraid. We bid you welcome who come with hope in your heart, who come with anticipation in your step, who come proud and joyous. We bid you welcome who are seekers of a new faith, who come to probe and explore, who come to learn. We bid you welcome who enter the hall as a homecoming, who have found here room for your spirit, who find in this people a family. Whoever you are, whatever you are, wherever you are on your journey, we bid you welcome. So now we will light the chalice. Wherever Unitarians gather across the world and across time, a flame is lit as a symbol of our shared spirit. As we light our chalice today, may its light remind us that we are part of something larger than ourselves. A web of wonder, possibility, and hope. Let this light be a beacon guiding us in our search for truth and meaning and reminding us of the beauty of the earth. Our first hymn this morning has been chosen, special request, as an answer and riposte to the despair that many of us have felt after this week. So let us sing with open heart, spirit, fortitude, and resilience, hymn number 108, My life flows on in endless song. Let us pray. Now is the accepted time, not tomorrow, not some more convenient season. It is today that our best work can be done, and not some future day or future year. It is today that we fit ourselves for the greater usefulness of tomorrow. Today is the seed time, now are the hours of work, and tomorrow comes the harvest and the playtime. And I would like us now to turn to the back of your hymn books, the promise that we make to ourselves and to each other of this church. And perhaps we can say it together, please. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To seek knowledge in freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine, this do we covenant with each other and with God. And our first reader is Tony Roach.
Okay. Today is Remembrance Sunday, and the dead in all wars are remembered, and God knows there are enough of them. But in particular, World War I seems to me to the forefront of that memory. And this is a poem. About World War I by W.B. Yeats, of course. I have my Yeats volume back. I found it. This is an Irish airman foresees his death. And just a brief note on the Irish airman. He was Lady Gregory's son, Robert Gregory, and he joined up as a pilot in the Royal Flying Corps and his plane crashed over Italy and he died. Not shot down at a recent Lady Gregory Autumn School. Somebody had something about some vaccination he'd taken and he shouldn't have been flying, basically. But anyway, he crashed and he died, and he left a widow and two young daughters at Coole with Granny. Anyway, this one more word is that the sentiments that Yeats ascribes to Robert Gregory here are very unlikely to be those of the loyal son of empire that was Robert Gregory. They're much more likely to reflect Lady Gregory, in that there is a conflict of allegiances. I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above. Those that I fight, I do not hate. Those that I guard, I do not love. My country is Kiltartan cross, my countrymen Kiltartan poor. No likely end could bring them loss, nor leave them happier than before. Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public men nor cheering crowds. A lonely impulse of delight led to this tumult in the clouds. I balanced all, brought all to mind. A waste of breath, the years to come. A waste of breath, the years behind. In balance with this life, this death.
Number 159, this is my song. Our second reading this morning is from My Dennis.
Good morning. Elaine has asked me to read this poem by Thomas Kettle. It has exactly the same sentiments, I would suggest, as Tony's. My friends are Kiltartan poor. Thomas Kettle was an Irish economist, journalist, barrister, writer, war poet, soldier, and home rule politician. As a member of the Irish Parliamentary Party, he was a Member of Parliament MP for East Tyrone from 1906 to 1910 at Westminster. He was actually born in Dublin. He joined the Irish Volunteers in 1913. And then on the outbreak of World War I in 1914, he enlisted for service in the British Army, where he was killed in action at the Somme. This poem was written 4 days before his death in September 1916. Sorry. It's a poem that he wrote to his daughter Betty, who had just been born. And he says, "To my daughter Betty, the gift of God." And he tries to explain to her that when she grows up, he is assuming he will probably die, and he's trying to explain to her when she grows up and gets into her prime, she may ask questions about why he did what he did. In wiser days, my darling rosebud, blown to beauty proud as was your mother's prime, in that desired, delayed, incredible time, you'll ask why I abandoned you, my own, and the dear heart that was your baby throne to die with death. And oh, they'll give you rhyme and reason. Some will call the thing sublime, and some decry it in annoying tone. So here, while the mad guns curse overhead, and tired men sigh with mud for couch and floor, know that we fools, now with the foolish dead, died not for flag, nor king, nor emperor, but for a dream born in a herdsman's shed, and for the secret scripture of the poor.
And now, as part of our meditation, because today is Remembrance Sunday, I'm going to ask Dennis Aylmer to come. And Dennis is going to talk to us a little bit about the particular families, people that we've lost from this congregation. And then we will have, he will bring the wreath, and then we'll have a moment of meditation around that, which will be brought to a close by the singing of hymn number 101, Abide With Me. So, do you want that?
Today, we remember all our relatives, friends, and loved ones, and particularly members of this congregation who died in war. So far, our records show just identify seven members of this congregation who were killed in the First World War. The first to go to be killed in those few short years was my two grand uncles, Cecil and Ewing Grimshaw, sons of my great-grandparents, whose memorial is down there. They're aged 39 and 48, respectively. But not long afterwards, absolute devastation hit this church. When, within 8 months of each other, five of our young men, aged just between 19 and 24, not long out of school, were killed. William Sidney Kidd, William Fitzgerald, Walter Varian, and Frederick and George Faulkner. The two Faulkner brothers were killed in 1 week. At this remove, it's simply not possible for us to experience the shock and utter devastation which hit their parents and family and indeed the whole congregation. And thank God this has never happened again since and never will again. And I can't do better than read a short extract from the poem by Lawrence Binyon, For the Fallen. They shall grow not old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them.
The title of my address this morning is The Garden. A few years ago, I was asked to write the introduction to a book of photographs, poems, and essays about the Irish National War Memorial Gardens, and since then, I've thought about them a lot. The gardens are nestled beside the Liffey, the main entrance tucked behind Gaelscoil in Chacor, and the St. John of God School in Island Bridge, Dublin 8. Officially, they're part of the Phoenix Park, even though they're on the opposite side of the river. Commemorations of the First World War remain contested in Ireland, although less than they used to be. In other jurisdictions, the architecture and social infrastructure of commemoration and the legacy of war is woven into everyday life. Local village monuments to the dead, family, military histories, and genealogies. I have never been comfortable with the valorization of military campaigns, despite having a grandfather and great-grandfathers who fought in wars. And this tension in remembering was also found in the attitudes of some local people towards the War Memorial Gardens, calling it Legion Park, in the decades after it was first built, unable or unwilling to see beyond political or cultural frames. We live in different times now, where the role and sacrifice of Irish soldiers in the World War I and World War II is acknowledged and properly commemorated. The Good Friday Agreement ushered in a new climate of respect that has been truly transformational in our country. While the War Memorial Gardens host annual services to remember the dead, they are no longer just a site to honour the past, but on sunny days are filled with families and dog walkers, people sitting by the riverside, watching the rowers from the boat clubs work their way to and from Chapel Izzard. Today, the Irish National War Memorial Gardens are variously referred to as the Memorial, the Rose Gardens, the War Memorial Gardens, or just the Gardens. Designed by the English architect Edward Lutyens, the idea for a war memorial for Irishmen had first been proposed in 1919. A committee was established to raise funds for a suitable commemoration. They commissioned the very best of Irish graphic artists, Harry Clark, to illustrate manuscripts recording the names of every known Irish soldier who had been lost in the war. These war books, running to 8 volumes, include just under 50,000 names and were completed between 1919 and 1923. Harry Clark created border designs in black ink, delicately mixing military scenes with Celtic revivalist iconography. The books needed a permanent home, and so the idea of a commemorative garden began to take root. It was not until 1929 that the present site, Long Meadows, was granted to the project, and the architecture of the memorial gardens that we see today was built in the 1930s. Yet Long Meadows has an older history. It is also the site of a Viking settlement and burial ground over 1,000 years old, so the symbolism of the gardens is complicated. Edwin Lutyens was an experienced architect in the design of both cemeteries and of war memorials. He designed Lambay Castle on Lambay Island and Howth Castle in the 1910s, which may explain his Irish connections to the memorial project. But he had also just finished a commission for a war memorial in New Delhi, for which he received a knighthood. His imperial credentials did not appear to be a problem for the Free State government. In fact, they were pleased to have the benefit of his expertise, and work on the gardens began in 1931. If you have never been there, let me try and paint a picture for you. The best way to enter the gardens is from a side gate on Concolbert Road. In the original plans, this was intended to be the main entrance. As you enter the park, you are taken down steps through a dark passage of evergreen oaks, until you emerge at the top of the gardens, where you step down into an open grass arena. This generous open space is circular, with a catafalque or war stone like a large granite altar at its heart. The war stone was intended to be a non-denominational monument for people of all creeds, and so it is here, rather than at the base of the imposing cross that leads into the garden, where wreaths are laid. Flanking the war stone on either side are two fountains with obelisks, and to each side of them are curved pergolas connecting the book rooms, which contain the illustrated manuscripts of the war names. Behind the pergolas on both sides are sunken, circular, and terraced rose gardens, each with steps leading down to a central lily pond. The intended and achieved effect is of a vast external cathedral, whose vaulted ceiling is the sky, and whose side chapels are rose gardens. Yet that is not all. Leaving the broad grass arena and moving away from the war stone, 6 giant bay trees mark a set of stone steps leading towards the river. These trees represent generals, and as you descend further down to the next level, there are rows of cherry blossom trees, glorious in April, in neat diagonal formations to represent battalions of soldiers. Walking through the soldiers brings you to a folly, a little temple perfectly sized for children to run through and around. And if you exit the gardens by a different route, your way is flanked by lime trees, soldiers on guard duty. As the year turns, their leaves move through shades of light green to russet, until all their beauty falls to the ground and makes the path a golden river. In winter, the gardens appear ghostly and dreamlike, centurion trees, skeletal and bare. In Theodor Ruffke's words, light making its own silence. They herald the landscape at the cusp of becoming, framed at the turn of day or the turn of season. The memorial gardens are slowly revealed as you walk into them, from whichever gate or entrance point. You cannot see them all at once. And this gradual revelation is part of the design and planned to create a particular experience. Standing in the open, flat heart of Lutyens Grass Arena, where the war stone occupies center space, you become aware of standing between earth and sky. And the encircling architecture, the book rooms, the pergolas, and the symmetry of the rose gardens invites the expansion not only of your vista, but also of your feelings. The gardens are a site of memory to remember the war dead, but they are also a reminder of the power of forgetting. Designed and built during a time when Ireland was extricating itself from empire, commemorating Irish soldiers' participation in the Allied forces was not popular. It became a matter of forgetting rather than remembering. The insistence on remembering, even when forgetting is easier, is one of the garden's lasting legacies. A garden, observed Emily Lawless, the Irish poet and naturalist, is a world in miniature, and like the world, has a claim to be represented by many minds surveying it from many sides. Literature is dotted with references to the pleasures and delights of gardens, from Andrew Marvell's evocation of a green thought in a green shade to Francis Bacon's declaration that a garden contains the purest of human pleasures. In ancient Islamic cultures, there's a particular design that has become replicated across time. It's of an enclosed garden organized along strict geometric principles with a quatrefoil central pool or element of water. Historically, this type of garden is most closely associated with the Persian Empire, and particularly the vision of Cyrus the Great, who lived about 500 years before the birth of Christ. Over the centuries, his conception of a garden spread across the Islamic world, and in the 16th century, extended to the first Mughal emperor in India. And we can see representations of the Persian garden in miniature paintings, spaces with terraces and pavilions, a style that has come to be known as a paradise garden. Our understanding of paradise or heaven would suggest that gardens are temporal manifestations of a celestial place. The metaphor of the garden as a place of spiritual reflection is an ancient one. It represents renewal, cycles of life, sun, earth, death, burial, and resurrection. However, in her book, The Garden Against Time, Olivia Lang reveals that the etymology of the word paradise comes from an ancient Persian language to mean walled garden. So this means that our conception of paradise comes from the idea of a garden and not the other way around. As Lang says, it was the garden that came first, heaven trailing in its wake, an enclosed garden, a fertile, beautiful, cultivated space that gave rise to the concept of celestial space. The Bible is abundant with allegories to sowing and reaping. The Song of Solomon is replete with references to gardens, fountains, apples, figs, lilies, as manifestations of earthly and divine love. Excuse me. The Garden of Eden, so deeply embedded within our culture, as a lost place, a place to which we will be restored, a place without pain or death, and one of eternal rest, is powerful. But it does not represent the reality of a garden at all. John Milton's Paradise Lost, first published in 1667, is a passionate evocation of Eden as a place of lushness, growth, vitality, but also work and the rewards of labor. Paradise Lost draws on the books of Genesis and Revelation and tells the story of Lucifer's fall and the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. Milton's Eden is not a garden of pretty flowers and neat beds requiring little attention, but is a place of untamed and wild abundance, with groves and glades and fields and shades of ripe fruit and fecundity. Eden is not cultivated and domestic, but unfettered and exciting. His poem was written at a time of civil and religious unrest in England and against a backdrop of plague. And perhaps today we better understand Milton's longing for wild landscapes, since our shared experiences of the fear of pandemic and the constraints of quarantine. Adam and Eve are not suburban inhabitants of the garden, but they are horticulturists. Their job is sweet gardening labor in a kind of ongoing dialogue with the garden's innate wildness as they work to maintain it through pruning and cultivation. As Eve says, "The work under our labor grows, luxurious by restraint. What we by day lop, overgrown, or prune, or prop, or bind, one night or two with wanton growth derides, tending to wild." Paradise Lost, Book 9. For Milton, ever the Puritan, Eve, of course, is closely associated with the chaotic, luxuriant, wild disorder of the garden and the need to contain it. But Eve strongly identifies with the garden she is so invested in. And in the poem, part of Eve's lamentation in being banished is how is she supposed to live without her garden, her natural element? How shall I part and wither, wander down into a lower world, to this obscure and wild? How shall we breathe in other air? Paradise Lost, Book 11. From Eden to Gethsemane, the garden and gardening are central metaphors for growth, but also grief. Excuse me. When Mary Magdalene sees Christ at the empty tomb, she initially mistakes him for a gardener. Jesus saith unto her, "Woman, why weepest thou? Whom seekest thou?" She, supposing him to be the gardener, saith unto him, "Sir, if thou have borne him hence, tell me where thou hast laid him, and I will take him away." John 20:15. In the Buddhist tradition, the garden is both a place of pleasure and a place of renunciation. The physical space of the garden is connected to a higher cosmos, reached by transcending the materiality of place. Gardens provide sensory delight, but also moral and intellectual restoration. They foster our understanding of the world. Gardeners tend, they do not grow. Reading about gardens and their importance as both wild and cultivated spaces, as physical and transcendental spaces, has made me think about the memorial gardens a little differently. Their perfect symmetry, their ornamental grandeur, their designed beauty. Because as Olivia Lang says, a garden exists on the threshold between artifice and nature, conscious decision and wild happenstance. It represents in miniature a type of balancing act, a tension between the way the world is and the world as we desire it to be. Being a gardener is about being initiated into a different understanding of time. We plant for a future we may not see. Garden time is not like ordinary time, says Lang. It moves in unpredictable ways, sometimes stopping altogether, yet proceeding always cyclically in a long, unwinding spiral of rot and fertility. Gardens work against the fantasy of perpetual abundance. So many of our most destructive behaviors are predicated on denying impermanence and decay, insisting on summer all the time. Permanent growth, constant fertility, perpetual yield, instant pleasure, maximum profit, outsourcing the labor. To accept the presence of death in the garden is to refuse an illusion of perpetual productivity without rest or repair, an illusion purchased at a heavy, soon unpayable cost. The words of Olivia Lang. To accept the presence of death in the garden is not only appropriate to us as gardeners, but also for an understanding of the garden as a repository of loss and remembrance. Gardens require continual attention, cultivation, and labor to thrive, as do we. The ancient Greeks had a word for it, eudaimonic, meaning flourishing, or living in accordance with the best of human principles and endeavors, which also means accepting impermanence and mutability. The idea of the garden as a space that brings out the best in us is particularly apposite when I think of the memorial gardens. Built to remember the price of our inhumanity, our capacity for conflict and brutality. The memorial gardens are a testament to the deeply scarring trauma of war, at the same time as they mark our capacity for forgiveness, reconciliation, regeneration, poetry, and love. Amen. We will now have our offertory. And now our notices. There is a meeting of the Managing Committee tomorrow evening at 7:30 via Zoom. HUGG, H-U-G-G, stands for Healing Unimaginable Grief Groups, is an organisation to support people who have been bereaved through a death by suicide. And on Sunday the 17th of November at 3 o'clock, HUGG will have a service of remembrance in this church. All are welcome. Please spread the word about this service. Just to say something about membership, the church is open and welcomes all who wish to attend. And if you feel that you share our ethos and would like to make your relationship with the church a little more formal, you've been attending the church for about a year, a first step is to sign our membership book, and there are forms available here if you want to do that. Signing the membership book is the first step to becoming a voting member of the church. This is the democratically elected church, and having signed the church, you can adopt to become a voting member of the church. Voting members have a vote at our annual general meeting, and we vote to elect our minister. But voting membership must be renewed every year, so please make sure you're up to date with that. Note to existing voting members, you have until the 31st of December to renew your membership, and to be a voting member, you must contribute to the life of the church community by joining a rota, attending Sunday services, or paying a nominal fee of €10. Forms to renew membership are also here. At this time, because of the time of the year that it is, there are some daffodil bulbs down here. I'll put them out. Please take a few. 5 bulbs is a good number. The reason for the bulbs is that as the days darken and winter sets in, we plant the bulbs. They appear to be dead, but we know in time that spring will come again and they will bloom. On Wednesday, there's a lunchtime service of reflection from 1 to about 1:35 in the church, but also available online. Josh has asked me to mention that the choir is starting to prepare for its Christmas carol service in mid-December, but there are plenty of opportunities for people to join, so if you would like to join the choir, have a word with Josh after the service. There are copies of November's Auscult available outside, and also copies of the Inquirer. On the 23rd of November, between 10 and 2, we're having a Polish Your Pew Day. And this is a kind of a collective winter cleaning, autumn cleaning. So don't all arrive at, we would like to stagger the amount of people who come. So either think about a 2-hour slot, maybe 10 to 12, or 12 to 2, 2 to 4, etc., so that we all don't come and, you know, overlap with each other. And talk to Bridget about that, I think, if you're interested in that. Tea and coffee are served in the Damer Hall afterwards. Please come and join us, especially if you're a visitor. And I would like to say thank you to all who helped me prepare for today. Bridget, Josh, my family. Thank you to Dennis Aylmer for marking the day so beautifully. Thank you for those behind the scenes who do the work. Ayla, preparing the church. Janet for the flowers, Oran and Arabella for the Sunday Club, and then the people who are downstairs boiling the kettles as we speak, and to all of you for being part of this community. So we now will sing our final hymn, which is hymn number 207, Earth Was Given as a Garden.
Thank you.
Gavin, my apologies. I forgot to, Gavin has a notice for us.
Hello, everyone. It is indeed, winter is indeed coming. Our bodies may not feel it, but our souls certainly do. So to that end, you are invited to join the International Group of Unitarian Ministry Students for an online service to welcome the winter. And it will be called Closer Through Connection. It's on Friday, this Friday coming at 7 p.m. And it says, the notice says featuring, but it will be led by ministry students. Myself from Ireland, students from the UK, the Netherlands, and our new friends in the Czech Republic. It will be on Zoom. If you get Eileen's email, if you're on the mailing list, it is in that. And you just click on the Zoom link. And do please join us for a moment of hygge, maybe, with your candle to welcome the winter. Thank you.
And now our final prayer and blessing. If here you have found freedom, take it with you into the world. If you have found comfort, go and share it with others. If you have dreamed dreams, help one another that they may come true. If you have known love, give some back to a bruised and hurting world. Amen.